welcome to my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. This is Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Maria by Be Optimistic, a band from across the pond hailing from the UK. But let's immediately turn our attention to tonight's show. At the top of the hour, we have author Charles Eisenstein. He is the author of The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, and our topic will be a revolution in human beingness. And if that sounds a bit vague to you, well, I'm going to ask Charles about his ideas for a new paradigm, about circle giving or gift giving, practicing partnership over domination, and how we must start being co-creative partners with Earth. Also, how he distinguishes between the feminine and masculine yin and yang, and how our state of starvation for connection has resulted in our addiction to food, drugs, shopping, sex, and TV. Then in the second part of the show, about 7 Pacific, I'll bring on Alan Johnson. He's written a lot about class, gender, and privilege. He's the author of The First Thing and the Last, a novel of redemption and healing in the aftermath of domestic violence, that crime so many dare not talk about. So, of course, we'll discuss that as well. But before we get to Charles, let me just clean up a little bit of housekeeping at the top of the show here. My show is Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts. They've started charging us, so we are looking for a sponsor. So if you enjoy Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I hope you will help nourish it and nurture it, because remember, what you nourish and nurture and tend to, will it thrive. Also, remember the 3 F's. If you're looking at my show page, you'll see the words there, favorite, friend, and follow. Click on those, and that way you're a part of the growing family of listeners here at Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Also, by clicking follow, you'll automatically get email reminders of my new guests each week. Also, if you haven't heard yet, I'm going to be leading a sacred tour to Turkey in November for men and women. We're going to experience the whirling dervishes, do Turkish baths, go to all the sacred archaeological sites of goddesses, visit wonderful museums. So if you're looking for a spiritual journey sometime soon with the like-minded who would like to drink in the essence of the Great Mother and her many forms and faces, don't hesitate to sign up for the trip. We're only going to take 20 people, and we still have seats left, but people are signing up pretty regularly. Also, while you're there at my website, where you can find out about all of the stuff I'm talking about, KarenTate.com, check out my 2 books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. They've garnered some prestigious endorsements, and I think you'll really like them, and I have special prices for show listeners. And look for the free stuff on my website. We all like free stuff. There's downloadable meditations, and don't miss the new article that I posted there. I just had an article published in the international magazine called La Luz International. The article is titled The Inhumanity of the GOP, Always for Profits, Not People. And don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in and talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in when I see you on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation and invite you to offer your comment or ask your question. So let's delay no further, because we have a lot to get to with Charles and Alan tonight. Let me start by telling you a bit about Charles. He's a writer, speaker, and as I already said, the author of the book, The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, and numerous essays online and in print. He's on the faculty of the Health, Arts, and Sciences program at Goddard College, and he lives in Pennsylvania with his 3 sons. His work covers economics, civilization, consciousness, transition, and health. His website is ascentofhumanity.com. And he also writes a lot for a website called realitysandwich.com, which I'm sure we'll probably get a chance to talk about. So, Charles, welcome to the show.
Hi.
First of all.
Hi. Thank you.
You know, I read Craig Bourne said, you've stood Darwin, Marx, and Adam Smith on their head with a whole new world view. And, you know, our topic tonight is a revolution of human beingness. So I'm assuming that's how you stood these folks on their head. So can you elaborate on what you mean by that and why you believe it's so important?
Well, I'm not the one who said that I stood them on their heads, but it's not totally inaccurate. I guess one way to look at it is that all of the revolutions past have been about basically about good defeating evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself is not a sufficiently deep revolution, as these days we're coming to understand that this dichotomy, this opposition is something that we've created and that it manifests as a war against everything and a war against the self. So it's and that it's kind of a remnant of the conquest of nature idea that developed in early agricultural civilization, where we
mm-hmm.
wanted to master nature and harness natural forces and all of these kind of dominator paradigms. And then on the personal level, you know, it's about overcoming sin or overcoming desire, or overcoming ego or overcoming fear. It's always overcoming something and conquering something. And I think that the revolution that's emerging in our time is to say, you know, we're not going to do that anymore. We're done fighting. And
well, let me ask you, Charles, are we seeing it play out in Wisconsin?
I don't know. That might be a stretch to
okay.
say that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly I think if you look for it, you could find it in Wisconsin. But it's still – what I see is still very much an us versus them, a good guys versus bad guys paradigm.
Well, I know part of what you talk about is we have to start looking at money and things like that differently. And it seems like Wisconsin is about the people with the money trying to take even more from the people who have a whole lot less. And
right.
I don't know, it just sort of feels like that's a good and evil thing when you see the inequity of incomes
right.
in our country.
Yeah. One of the things I've been writing about in Sacred Economics, which is a separate book, The Ascent of Humanity, was my last book and Sacred Economics.
Oh, they're two
Economics.
Separate books. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. But it's not coming out till July.
Okay.
But one thing I write about is how money itself, the way that it's created, the way that it circulates, has a pressure built into it to create increasing polarization of wealth and endless growth. It's kind of a design feature of money. And that design feature embodies the deep defining stories or myths of our civilization. Two of them. There's two main ones that I talk about. One of them is separation, the separate self, that says, well, what is it to be human? Well, you know, you're this bubble of psychology inside a robot made of flesh. You know, you're a skin-encapsulated soul. You're a maximizer of your genetic self-interest, or you're a maximizer of your economic self-interest, but you're this separate being. And that's what we've come to define ourselves as. And the other part of the story, is ascent, that I alluded to earlier, that humanity's destiny is to conquer nature, transcend nature, and then onward and upward to the universe, to conquer the atom, to conquer death, to conquer disease, you know, to become
right.
the lords and masters. And so these two stories are embodied in money. And because, like, you know, these stories are becoming obsolete, and therefore the institutions built on top of them are becoming obsolete too. And that's why the money system is in such crisis. And when things get into their terminal stages, they often take on extreme forms. And I think what we're seeing now is the last gasp of the holders of the status quo, because for it to work, the polarization of wealth has to keep increasing and increasing and increasing. And so they're looking now, what else can we convert into money?
But why is that, Charles? I mean, why? I mean, these people probably have gold toilet seats. You know, I mean, why do they need more and more and more? Why can't they just be satisfied with more money than God? Why isn't it, you know, when is enough enough? I mean, is there
yeah.
no conscience in with, you know, in the suffering they're causing other people?
Well, you know,
are we talking about two different things?
Yeah, I know a fair number of wealthy people, and they worry more about money than most poor people do that I know. They're in a state of constant insecurity. What if this? What if that? What if the stock market goes down? What if I, you know, lose my job? What if I lose my benefits? You know, what if the price of gold falls? They're, even though, like, objectively from the outside, we could say that they have enough and more than enough, their consciousness is a state of lack, and they always want more money. And I think that the reason, it's not because they're greedy or bad people, but it's that the society that we live in is so disconnected that we, just by being born into it, disconnected from community, disconnected from nature, that we want to compensate for this loss of connection by owning more and more stuff. So
right.
It's an expansion, you know, it's an expansion of the private realm in compensation for the loss of our connected being.
Well, wasn't it a philosopher, Eric Fromm, I think it was, that said there are two different modalities of people: people who either live to have things, or people who live to be. You know, they're more interested in experiences. Is this sort of the same thing in a way that, you know, these people feel like they need more and more because of fear, insecurity? They don't stop and think that most people, you know, worry about that every day, but their fear is a lot more real than, you know, these folks who, you know, have jets and, you know, multiple houses and more money than any of us would even know how to spend.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can say, objectively speaking, they have, the wealthy have a lot less that they should be fearful about. But nonetheless, the feeling of lack is still very powerful. Subjectively, it's just as powerful.
I see. Well, let's go back to the nature part, and we'll work back a little bit
yeah.
into the story of money and that disconnection or connection. You've said humankind has attempted to dominate rather than partner with nature. Well, that's a topic myself and my listeners are very much aware of. But just
yeah.
for those who maybe they've heard this for the first time, they don't really get it, give some examples. And where does this come from? I mean, my first idea would be, well, it's Judeo-Christianity. But maybe you have a different view on it.
Yeah, I think it goes back earlier than Judeo-Christianity, and it's common to all agricultural civilizations. You know, past the level of subsistence farmers. Once they began to build agricultural civilizations with mass society and division of labor, then and population grew to exceed the carrying capacity of the land, then a whole new mindset developed that, you know, that all of a sudden nature wasn't your friend anymore necessarily. You could have plagues of locusts, you know, you could have droughts, floods, but even just having, you know, domesticated plants and animals puts us in a different relationship to the rest of nature than we had before. So if you see natural forces as a threat, then you're going to want to dominate, want to overcome them. And the perception then is that the more you control things, then the more secure you will be and the better life will be. So in modern times, it goes to the extreme of, you know, spraying Roundup on fields and killing everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's already past the extreme. Back in the 50s, scientists were saying, in the wonderful future, we will live on an earth with no insects. We will have eliminated every pest.
Yeah, do away with the bees. Why don't you?
Yeah. Well, we will grow our food in laboratories. We won't need the bees. That was the attitude, and people kind of nodded their heads and believed it. Look at the Jetsons, you know, the cartoon about the future.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
There's no living being except for human beings. Even the dog is a robot.
Oh, you know, I don't remember that, but you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was and it's all above the earth in these towers, you know. And everything is artificial, everything's synthetic. That was considered to be this gleaming, clean, modern future, you know. And we've really gotten past that. Like, I don't think anybody aspires to that future anymore. So these stories are becoming obsolete.
Well, who would you say are the enemies of this shift toward connection and, you know, co-creation with nature? Who, you know, who are the people still resistant besides Monsanto?
Anybody is resistant who, for whom the old story is still working, for whom the world of separation, the old normal, is still working.
Okay, I like that phrase, the old normal.
Yeah, yeah, and see, the old normal, the society, and the way of life, and the state of being that's based on separation, is unsustainable because it generates growing crises. And so today we're seeing all of these crises, you know, ecological crisis, financial crisis, political crisis, healthcare crisis, educational crisis, in every realm there's a crisis. And these have been managed at increasing effort for a long time, but now they're becoming unmanageable. And as they become unmanageable, they invade people's lives in various ways, and normal becomes intolerable, and people then begin to change. Like, I mean, personally, like, I never change until what I've been doing doesn't work anymore. And even then, I keep trying to do it for a while, you know. But eventually, I just have to give up and step into a new world. And I think that is happening.
So if you don't mind, you know, just for the sake of example, do you mind saying what the new normal is for you and how you live your life, maybe just to give, you know, listeners an idea what you're talking about in terms of the new normal?
Well, it has many dimensions, and I live it in some ways, and in other ways I'm still very much in the age of separation. But the new normal is anything that arises from the felt, lived knowledge of connection or oneness, or I like to use the word interbeingness.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, I say the idea, it's more than just an idea, though. A lot of people have the idea, but it's just an intellectual idea. But it's the knowledge that the other is not separate from the self, that something of you is within me, that what I do to the world, I'm also doing to myself.
So it's sort of along the lines of like what the indigenous people have been trying to make us see for a long time. It's mm-hmm. It goes back to that old pagan idea of the interconnection of all things, that we're like this matrix, this web.
Right.
Rather than think that, you know, the capitalism doesn't have victims kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've been, you know, as a society, as a civilization, we've been pretending for a long time or imagining that what we do to the world, we can insulate ourselves from that. You know, we can pollute this river, but that's okay. We can filter the water, or we can move somewhere else, or we can develop some technology to deal with the consequences of the last technology. You know, we can escape it. You know, there's pollution somewhere. There's riots in Algeria or whatever. But that's okay. That's somewhere else. We can separate ourselves. We can dump toxic waste into the sinkhole, and we can move somewhere else. You know, we can escape.
Well, are you surprised at how quickly we Americans have forgot about what happened down in the Gulf?
Well, I'm not too surprised, because for most people, it didn't impact their lives in any direct way. For most people, it was just pixels on a screen. you know, sound bits coming out. Like, did the price of a cheeseburger go up? You know, maybe the price of shrimp went up a little bit, but most people, it affects them the exact same amount that a horror movie affects them.
In the moment, but not a lasting for change kind of an effect.
Right, because people are we're still successfully able to insulate ourselves from the consequences of our actions. But that illusion is becoming harder and harder to maintain.
Okay. Well, all right, so getting to this idea of connection. We're disconnected, and we're trying to keep the old normal working for us. But you say at the same time we're in a state of starvation for connection. How do you recognize that? I mean, if people are, you know, still don't want to care about one another, I mean, so many don't want to care about the earth, where can we witness, I guess, the starvation? What's the proof of it?
Well, one proof of it is just what we were talking about before, that people want more and more and more money, more and more stuff, even though they already have enough. Why would somebody want more and more when they already have enough? It's because they're hungry for something else. People who are not wealthy satisfy this starvation maybe by eating more and more food.
Ah, I see.
Or engaging in some other addiction that numbs the wantingness, that salves the deficit of being. Because if we are our connections and we're not this bubble of psychology and a flesh robot, then when we're cut off from our connections, when we're cut off from nature, when we no longer can see a bird and know what its song is and know what plants it eats and be intimate with the hills and the land and to know the story of every face that we see, that's what human beings are supposed to have. You know, we're supposed to be in this matrix of connection, and lacking that and so cut off, we don't even know our neighbors anymore. You know, we don't.
It's true.
So
let me ask you if I'm getting this. So the starvation for connection, that plays out in the rich guy even wanting more and more because he doesn't really know what he really wants. Is that what you're saying? He's filling the void with money and things and power?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a deficit of being that it's a wound that everybody carries in one way or another because of our cutoff from our true, vast, infinite, connected being. So in compensation for that, we try to enlarge the finite separate self to make it as big as the infinite connected self. But of course, no matter how much you enlarge the separate self, you're never going to come anywhere near the true vastness of the connected self. No amount is enough. Literally, no amount is enough.
Well, let me just say this, okay, and this might sound hokey, okay?
Yeah.
You know, when I was a younger woman and I first got married, you know, I was fortunate enough early in life to have the house and two cars and a job that afforded me to be able to do what I wanted to do. But, you know, the void in me at the time, you know, I realized that those things didn't fill the void. You know, maybe I was fortunate to learn that early on. For me, what filled the void was love and, you know, doing things like travel. You know, maybe I fall into that Eric Fromm, the being person rather than the having person. Would you define, you know, love maybe or being as part of this connection that we're so starved for? I mean, was I just lucky to figure out that the things didn't matter early?
I think love is this identity with another being. You know, if you love somebody, then their pain is your pain and their joy is your joy. There's no rational reason why you should care if your loved one is happy or not, but you do, because you're experiencing the truth that you are not separate from that.
Okay.
Being.
Okay,
so,
all right.
Yeah.
So love is part of this this revolution of human beingness. I mean, you know, feminists for a long time have been trying to dispel the propaganda out there about what it really is. And, you know, we've come to try to say today, well, we want a caring culture. I would think from what you're describing to me, that's a revolution in human beingness, because I don't see a caring culture much when I look out there. It feels like just a lot of domination or attempts at domination.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that what gives me a lot of heart and hope these days is that domination isn't working very well anymore. Working less and less well for the dominators.
Right. Well, and you in the love thing, I mean, I'm just realizing that you said something about the heart is the true decider, that the separation between body and heart is finished and the heart is the true decider. Does that go back to love and caring for our fellow human being as well?
Yeah. What I'm thinking about when I talk about that is that we've believed for a long time that the way to make decisions is by figuring out the answer. Figuring out, that's a very mental metaphor. You know, you kind of weigh the pros and cons and
Well, it's very left brain.
Yeah. Like, what if this and what if that? And kind of, even in school, we're taught to make a list of pros and cons and assign them a weight, you know, and government does this when they do a cost-benefit analysis, you know, and then through the exercise of reason, you're supposed to be able to figure out the right choice. But if you ever try to make a choice like that, even if you do, you're still left with indecision afterward, and uncertainty and doubt. You know, was that really the right choice?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that the heart is the appropriate organ to know and to choose. And
And that to me is sounding like one of the attributes usually assigned to the feminine consciousness, you know, the intuition, the heart, as opposed to the left brain, literal nuts and bolts kinds of decision making.
Yeah, and one way to look at what's happened to our civilization is that these left brain functions have exceeded their appropriate domain and usurped other modes of knowing and other modes of being.
Well, did you happen to stumble across Daniel Pink's book where he says the right brain thinkers are going to be the people who have success in the future because you can't outsource right brain qualities?
No, I haven't come across that. Although I think that the definition of success is going to be very different. Today, success means the control of resources.
What do you think it's going to be for us in the future? Because so many of us are just perplexed at what will this paradigm really look like, you know? And I think it brings up a lot of fear in people because, you know, it's sort of like the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. You know, you go back to your husband sometimes because he beat you. At least you know what to expect. I mean, it's a horrible metaphor, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's a pretty good metaphor. I mean, that's kind of, you know, what we as a society keep doing. But at some point, people do leave. But, as far as what success will look like or what wealth will look like, I think that we're going to relearn what primitive and perhaps you could say matriarchal societies practiced, but not even just matriarchal societies, even some of the like potlatch societies. In those societies, the wealthiest person was the person who gave the most, not the person who had the most.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, this sounds like a good segue to Genevieve Vaughan's gift giving. Is what she calls gift giving, and what she's trailblazed with that idea of the gift economy. Is that similar to your idea of, I think, do you call it circle giving? Is that your term?
No, actually, I haven't really called it circle giving, but I do talk about a gift circle and how gifts naturally flow in circles and expand. Lewis Hyde writes about this too. They expand the sense of self to include more and more others. Because, like, say, and Genevieve Vaughan, I've read like a little bit of her stuff and picked up some of her vibe, but haven't really studied it. But I just recognize her as an important thinker in gift economics. So if you're in a gift community, then it's no longer true that more for you is less for me. Because in a gift community, if you have more than you need, you give it to somebody else in the circle or in the community. And that person, if they have more than they need, they'll give it and give it and give it. And so it gravitates toward the one who needs, who actually needs something.
Okay.
And because you've been giving a lot, you know, gifts generate gratitude. And gratitude then is your security. If you're if you're a giver of many gifts, then when you're in need, many people will be very happy to help you.
Right, right, right.
So
well, you know,
very,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
You're making me think about an article I read recently and I had in my What's the Buzz segment where it talked about poor people tend to have better social skills because they depend on one another, where rich people just, well, they just go hire somebody. And, you know, that the relationship, the bond, the human beingness is sort of taken out of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and,
poor people have much
so,
more community.
Right, 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 right.
They actually need each other, yeah.
Right, and maybe that's why the people in Cairo were in the streets by the million, because these people all were connected, you know, in the ways we're talking about. You know, they had empathy for one another's plight.
Yeah, I think so, and they had a street to go into. You know, here the streets are, there's not people in the streets.
Right.
You know, what are you going to do, go on the interstate highway, you know?
So talk a little bit more about the circle giving. I mean, do you think it's sort of a, in a way, it's sort of a barter, or is it not one thing for another? It's just you give if you don't need it. I mean, I know you had an article about, a wonderful article. I mean, it described a whole ritual, you know, how it worked.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, some of us have been experimenting with trying to relearn gift culture. And one of the experiments was called the Gift Circle. It was developed by this guy out in California, Alpha Lowe, out in he's in Berkeley, I think. And basically you just gather a group of people and everybody, you go around the circle and everybody describes something that they would like to give. And then you go around again, and everyone describes something that they need. And as you go around, you know, you can break in, like you say, oh, I have, you know, a lawnmower that we inherited with the house and we don't need it and it works fine. And then, you know, and more often than not, someone in the circle is like, hey, I need a lawnmower, or I know somebody who needs a lawnmower.
Mm-hmm.
And so these connections happen.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, people become they develop gratitude towards this group that's meeting their needs, and ties form.
Gratitude is our currency, really. Gratitude will be our currency.
Right, or gratitude, our currency or our savings account.
Right.
It's not a bad idea to begin putting some in that savings account now, you know, because...
Help people how you can, you know, because... I mean, because a lot of us have more than we need, and it just doesn't occur to us to see if the old lady down the hall might like a potluck dinner one night or something, or whatever you want to do, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I'm thinking about this thing that's sort of I'm calling it a thing because I don't know what word to use. But as the economy was so bad, we started to hear, I think I heard Arianna Huffington talk about it first. She brought to light some groups of people who were unemployed, and rather than staying home in their hopelessness, they got together online or in circles or something like that and offered their services to people free who didn't have money, you know, for services that they needed, handyman or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the same thing, I guess, what you're saying.
Yeah, and those things can develop into whole alternate economies.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now I know you believe, or at least I've, you know, if what I read was had quoted you correctly, you believe we can't grow the economy anymore. And I'm curious, is that why Wall Street is sort of resorting to like these trash derivatives, because we don't make anything in the country to sell anymore, so they're selling, you know, junk paper?
Yeah, that's one symptom of it.
Okay. Well, yeah. I guess I don't know. You tell me, but. If there's nothing left to convert to goods and services, then do we need something to take its place, or what takes its place?
Well,
or am I not understanding your point there?
Okay. Yeah, I can explain it. Basically, the way that money is created today necessitates economic growth, because if, say, I'm a banker, money's created through interest-bearing debt, okay? Whether it's the Federal Reserve buying treasury notes and thereby putting money into circulation, or if it's a bank writing a loan and creating money in your checking account, which you then spend, money is always accompanied by debt, which means that at any given moment, there's more money owed than there is money in existence. The only way that to prevent bankruptcies and wealth polarization is if even more money is created by the time the debts come due, but that even creates a necessity for even more money. So one way to look at it is okay, so the amount of money in existence has to keep growing, therefore the amount of goods and services that are defined as things exchanged for money, also that realm has to keep growing as well. So, for example, if I'm a banker and you come to me for a loan and you say, yeah, I'd like to borrow $1 million to buy up this wetlands and protect it forever, mm-hmm. I won't be able to pay you back money with interest. Maybe someday I could pay you back $1 million if I sell it, but I'm not going to make any money from this. Well, then someone else comes and says, I'd like to borrow $1 million to buy the wetlands and pave it over and build a subdivision, and I'll make $2 million. And I'll pay you back your million plus interest, and I'll get rich too. And I'll say, you're a smart young woman, I will make you that loan. So the money goes to people who are going to create more goods and services, who are going to expand the money realm. And you could do that by cutting down trees, by pumping oil, by doing things for people that they once did without money, for example, cooking or childcare, or wise advice from an elder, now mm-hmm. having become psychotherapy or coaching or something. So what's happened is that the non-monetized realm has been converted into goods and services. People, even when I was a kid, we never dreamed of paying for water, for drinking water.
Right.
You know, there wasn't bottled water. And neighbors watched each other's kids as a matter of course, and we hardly ever ate out.
Right.
Or bought takeout, right? And so all of these things, food preparation, childcare, drinking water, have been converted into money. We've converted natural resources into money, groundwater, the biodiversity, the fish in the ocean. All of these things have been converted into money to keep pace with the growth machine.
Well, you're making, you know, and I mean, believe me, I'm no expert on economics. It sort of makes my eyes glaze over, quite frankly, and I'm ashamed to admit it. My friends would say, Karen, why will you admit to that publicly? But it's true, so I'll say it. But, you know, I heard this economist was talking, I think, to Laura Flanders or Amy Goodman, I forget which, and he was from Germany or something, and he was talking about growth versus development. And I really was intrigued by what he said. He said, you know, we have to stop thinking in terms of growth, we have to start thinking in terms of development.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave the example of this a woman in some third world country that made shawls to support her family. And it
mm-hmm.
took her a long time to make the shawl. And, you know, and so they gave her a machine so she could make more shawls in
mm-hmm.
a shorter period of time to make more money. Well, they go back and check on her 3 months later, think, well, oh, she's going to be rolling in the dough in her little village there, but
mm-hmm.
she's still only making one shawl. And they said, why? And she said, well, because I want to have time to spend with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know what? This woman's got it. You know, she's smarter than, you know, all of these other people that, you know, go around wanting to own the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least that's what it felt like to me. So is that what you're saying, too, this idea of development over, you know, our personal development over growth, you know?
Well, yeah, that's part of it, because one of the things I'm writing about in this new book, Sacred Economics, is a different kind of money system that doesn't necessitate endless growth, that would be consistent with a steady state economy or a degrowth economy. And what that means, a degrowth economy doesn't mean that we're all getting poorer. It means that we're doing less and less things for money.
Mm-hmm.
But we could still have just as much wealth. In fact, we could even be wealthier in subjective terms. We could be surrounded by more beautiful things. You know, we could have more nature. We could have more gardens.
Quality of life.
That's right. But we'd be doing less of it for money.
Right, right.
Less of it for money.
But, Charles, do you find that some people, I go back to this, maybe it's the Judeo-Christian ethic, or maybe they're brainwashed by I don't know who. But, you know, they tell me stuff on Facebook even, you know, or they'll email me after a show and they'll say, well, nobody promised you an easy life. Like, people who just want quality of life are somehow lazy and sinful. You know, if you have a lot of money, well, that means, you know, God is blessing you. If you don't have any money, you must be a sinner. You know, and that I have to tell you, that just makes my blood boil. It's like they've bought into this idea that, you know, it's okay to work three jobs to pay for health care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, people, I mean, just like kind of on a human, emotional, or spiritual level, like I just want to say that when people are in a state of judgmentality that way and using their good work habits or their wealth to congratulate themselves, you know, like people need to find some way to love themselves. And if their only way to give themselves permission to love themselves is because of their big bank account or their six-pack abs or whatever it is, then that's better than nothing. Those things are very fragile, though.
So in other words, the guy who prides himself on working three jobs, that's really just sort of his fragile ego that we're hearing.
It's a cover for his pain.
Cover for his pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe that'll help me be gentler next time I get I get somebody write me something like that. Well, so Charles, I feel like you're so ahead of the curve than most of us on visualizing this new state of being. Besides the gift giving and the gratitude currency, I mean, what does it mean is going to change? I mean, are you visualizing governments will still be intact, or are we talking about going more to sort of a tribal, smaller community kind of way of life?
I think that there will still be governments on various levels. Part of the vision is that money will be, and economics will be based on resources. So if you take something that should belong to all, such as oil or aquifer water or soil fertility or biodiversity or fish from the ocean, then the profit you make should go to all.
Okay.
And you wouldn't be able to profit from your exclusive ownership of part of what should be the commons. So you might be able to profit this is a kind of a big conversation. Basically, some resources and some aspects of Gaia are under global stewardship. And, for example, maybe for CO2, it's the global levels of CO2 that are important. But most things should be under local stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know, anything that has to do with the bioregion and
mm-hmm.
And anything whose implications are mostly local will be under local stewardship. So I see a devolution of political authority much more to regions and localities. But I think there'll still be government.
Is there a plan in your future to do away with the military-industrial complex? Can we make them obsolete, or is that part of the shift?
I think it's becoming obsolete for a lot of reasons. Certainly one reason is the advent of nuclear weapons, which makes total war between the great powers impossible,
mm-hmm.
and really puts a crimp in the amount of war that we can make. And I think consciousness is changing, too. I mean, sometimes we see things that make us feel like things are getting worse, you know, that torture has once again become acceptable in the public consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the stuff that happened in Egypt and Tunisia was really heartening.
Yeah.
That the military said, no, we're not gonna go out there and shoot people. So I think consciousness is changing, and that, you know, a lot of war is over the control of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a product of the economic system, and it's a product of the need that money drives to control wealth. It comes from the concentration of wealth that's built into the money system.
So does this new sacred economics, does it replace capitalism?
It changes capitalism.
Something we don't have a word for quite yet, I guess.
You could still call it capitalism. Capitalism is a really loaded word. I still think that there will be large aggregations of capital that are deployed through the decisions of human beings. But just imagine how different society would be if wealth were a matter of how much you gave rather than how much you owned.
Absolutely.
That's how it used to be. Even like if you read Norse sagas and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, the king is always having to give like these huge banquets and feasts, and anytime the you know, Viking hero goes to visit the king of Sweden or whatever, he gives him rich gifts. You know, the kings had to give like all kinds of gifts out. That was kind of a vestige of these earlier potlatch societies, you know.
Okay. Even wrote in my Rebirth and Goddess book that we should measure ourselves by the services we provide, you know, or being in service is what I meant, being in service rather than our bank book. And so, I totally agree with your idea here. Let me just ask you, because we probably have about 10 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
This time's flown already. In your article, Testicular Age, you say for several thousand years it's been the masculine yang and feminine yin that have dominated our understanding of what it is to be a man or a woman. I'd imagine, Charles, many folks, even some of my listeners, might not realize there's the other side of both yin and yang. And you believe we're on the cusp of a civilizational transition where we'll move toward the masculine yin and the feminine yang, that these qualities within ourselves will be our ascendancy. Can you explain that to my listeners?
Yeah, well, this idea comes from a woman, Jeannie Haddon, who wrote a book called Reuniting Self, Sex, and Spirit, or something like that. I was just kind of riffing on her idea.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that, you know, she actually bases it on anatomy. So the masculine yang is the phallic energy. So it's about it's upward and rising and forging into new territory and thrusting forward, you know, and breaking boundaries and it's impatient and you know, wants to explore new territory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the female yin, which we associate with femininity, is the receptive vagina, you know, the
mm-hmm.
and it's receptive and submissive and nurturing and passive and all that. But she says there's two other two other poles or two other parts of this quadrant. So the male yin, which is the testicular male, it's undergirding, it's supportive, it's regenerative, it's conserving. And we recognize these as kind of male qualities, you know, but mm-hmm. they haven't been emphasized in our culture.
Right.
And then the female yang is the birthing womb, as opposed to the receptive womb, you know, the birthing womb, or the menstruating womb.
Because it's
about,
active, it's not passive.
That's right. It's propelling something into a new era. It's dissolving the old. And again, this has not been encouraged or emphasized. So I was playing around with that idea in that essay and saying, yeah, maybe we're moving into an age where maybe we're even coming back into balance.
Right.
I mean, there's certainly a place for all four, and all four exist in each person, man or woman, too.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there are people that would say, you know, we should get to the point where we're not differentiating between the masculine and feminine, because obviously we both have those things inside of us. But, I think there's probably a large segment of the population that doesn't understand this or probably never even heard this concept before.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think of like this interview I had once with this radio show host, and he was asking me about goddess, and he said, well, what would people think if we, you know, people here in the United States suddenly adopted a goddess instead of a god? You know, they
yeah.
would think we were just weak. You know,
yeah.
And so I had to tell them about Kali and Sekhmet and the Morrigan, and you know,
yeah.
it's just this preconceived idea that the female cannot be a warrior.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I mean, you're up, Jim.
Well, I actually interrupted you, but
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that for one thing, I like difference, but you know. In a way, the whole idea of a separate divinity, whether it's a god or a goddess, is itself part of this male patriarchal paradigm, that there's this, you know, separate from materiality, and the separate thing is divine, and materiality, that's just mundane.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that in itself was an idea that only originated with patriarchal societies.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Well, before we had the goddess, she was nature. She connected everything. So it feels, I mean, at least that's the way, you know, a lot of us look at it. So we mm-hmm. we severed that idea of connection, which we feel was sourced from the female for patriarchy, and look where it's gotten us.
Yeah.
So it's like we have
yeah.
to go back, you know, go
yeah.
back. But with the male and the female in balance, and I know like there's some people I talk to that say the male has to change his archetype. Instead of the male being the warrior, the male has to be the protector. You know, then he's not. Then he's only aggressive, you know, in a protector
mm-hmm.
mode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that every archetype, every institution has a counterpart in a more beautiful world. And so you could think about, one way to address what you were saying is you think about, well, what is the essence of a warrior? What is that in the most beautiful world that you could imagine? And I would say a warrior is somebody who will fearlessly protect what he or she loves.
Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps the armed forces or the military of the future, the warriors of the future, will be people who put their lives on the line to protect nature.
Rather than stealing resources,
yeah.
natural resources.
Yeah.
Looking after the interests of multinational corporations.
Yeah.
Reality Sandwich, is that your blog or do you just contribute to it?
I'm just a contributor.
You have a lot of articles there. I'd really recommend my listeners go to both your website and let's see, what's the name of it again? Ascent, of humanity.com, and also read some of the stuff you've written at Reality Sandwich. You had something that really caught my eye. It's a little off the subject, but it's interesting. Elephants, please don't go. The first line caught me. If the elephants go extinct, there will be nuclear war. Do you remember writing that?
Yeah, that was the lead-in that they put there. That sentence is actually somewhere in the middle of the article. But
the teaser.
Yeah.
What were you thinking when you were writing that?
It was something about memory, elephants being holders of memory,
mm-hmm.
and that if we lose these holders of memory, then we're going to repeat. We're going to repeat nuclear war. That it just kind of came to me, you know.
Sort of like that saying, you know, those who forget history are destined to repeat.
Yeah.
Kind of that thing.
But I just kind of got this like premonition that if they go extinct, there will be nuclear war.
It would be horrible if they went extinct. Such noble beasts. I guess I'm a softie, but every time I read there's only, 10 snow leopards left, I go into a funk for the rest of the day, because sometimes, I think, these poor creatures, they offer more value than, some of our, skin bags that walk the earth. But I guess I'm being a little extreme. Charles, we're probably in the next minute or two, my other guest is going to call in. So what haven't I asked you that you think would be important for my listeners to know about your new world paradigm or how you see things changing?
Well, I think that just like on a personal level, what a lot of people are turning to and what I often urge people to do is to orient one's own choices toward the gift, toward the question, what do I want to give in this situation? It's not something to force or a matter of self-sacrifice, and if I give, then I'm being a good person. But it's a desire. It's a feeling like I want to live my life, not the life I'm paid to live. And why am I here on Earth? I'm here on Earth because I have unique gifts to give to the world, to give to other people, to give to whatever. And if I don't give those gifts, then I'm going to feel like I haven't really lived my life. And I think it's this positive desire that is present, however deeply buried, in rich and poor alike, that we have to appeal to. And not to say, you're a worthless skin bag, but that, step into your life and live your purpose. And then we don't have to defeat evil anymore to have a beautiful world.
Yeah, because we would all be living the generosity and living the gratitude.
Mm-hmm. So it's to see people with the eyes of, I know that you want to do something beautiful in your life, and you might be blocked through all of these wounds and all of this anxiety and scarcity and fear, but when you see people with those eyes and with that knowing, then you create a space for them to step into who they really want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, because if you use guilt and stuff and judgment and condemnation to pressure them, they just get reactive and defensive, and it doesn't
right.
work.
Right. Yeah, I know that's true. Do you know of any organizations that, for instance, aside from starting something like this yourself, are there already groups out there that people can tap into that might be trying to perpetuate this right now, that they could, jump on the coattails of it and, start making themselves feel better and putting deposits in their gratitude bank?
I think that when you form the intention to begin living in the gift, then opportunities arise that call your gifts and awaken your gifts. So, and then you'll find those organizations and those opportunities.
Well, and when you look at this economy, I'm sure really people don't have to look far to find kids that need clothes or people that need food. I mean, even if you're just donating canned goods to a food bank.
Yeah. But it's more than that. I mean, those things are a start, but really what we're talking about is what you're doing with your essential life energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it really comes down to. You know, we're all given gifts, and we want to use them in a way that passes those gifts forward. So if you have a job that doesn't engage your gifts, or that puts your gifts toward a use that you don't believe in, that doesn't feel beautiful to you, then you're going to feel like you're living someone else's life. You know, you're being paid to do something you don't want to do. You're a slave.
Right. And you're unfulfilled and unhappy. And,
yeah.
You know, that sort of bleeds out into all other phases of your life.
Yeah. So that's where we're really going. But certainly,
right. Yeah, because, well, you know, they say it over and over again, you know, how good it feels to give.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we don't hear that enough. I don't think in our society it's sort of been overshadowed by greed is good.
Right.
Well, Charles, it has been a pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight. And let me just give your website one more time, ascentofhumanity.com. Your book is The Ascent of Humanity, and your new book coming out is Sacred Economics. That's right?
Yep. That's
okay,
right.
Okay, good. Well, I will be in touch, and I just want to say thank you so very much for the work you're doing in the world and the inspiration you're providing.
Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Good night.
So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, or the feminine consciousness, as some call it, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values have the real juice to save the world. And you've been listening to Charles Eisenstein give us some ideas on what this paradigm shift we've all been talking about, praying for, pushing for. Well, he gave us some ideas what it just might look like if we want to uplift our species and save Mother Earth. Well, it's that time when we cross the threshold into the next part of the show, when I take a very brief 1 minute music break to get ready for my next guest. He's Alan Johnson, and our discussion is going to be on domestic violence and his new fiction book that talks about that. We're also going to talk a little bit about gender, privilege, and power. So I know you'll stay with me for the next minute here. And while I go, I'm going to let you listen to Choose Love by Laura Kane for 60 seconds.
I say I will. Take the ride, 'cause I'd rather have connection, pleasure and pain than be alone here with my pride. Okay, I'll take my shot. This time I'll take my chance, 'cause that's all I'll have left.
I hope it is.
Well, thank you for calling in tonight. Let me start by sharing your bio with some of my listeners, and then we'll start talking about your book and the good work you're doing out there in the world.
Okay.
Alan Johnson, listeners, he is a writer and a public speaker who's worked on issues of privilege, oppression, and social inequality since receiving his PhD in sociology from the University of Michigan. He began his work in the 70s with a focus on men's violence against women. After 30 years of college teaching, he now devotes himself entirely to writing and public speaking. He's worked with more than 200 schools and organizations in 36 states. His nonfiction books include The Forest and the Trees, Sociology as Life, Practice, and Promise, the Blackwell Dictionary of Sociology, the Gender Knot, Unraveling Our Patriarchal Legacy, and Privilege, Power, and Difference. His writing has been translated into several languages and excerpted in numerous anthologies, and The First Thing and the Last is his first published novel. So, Alan, I want to talk about your fiction book about domestic violence, and, you know, that book has a very interesting life of its own on its journey toward actually getting published. But, you know, I don't want to put the horse before the cart, so to speak. You know, in your work, since you talk a lot about issues of privilege, oppression, and social inequalities, don't these things start off first, and maybe they lead to or give license to domestic violence?
Oh, yes. I mean, at the heart of men's violence against women, but also against other men, is a system of male privilege that defines masculinity in terms of a man's ability to always be in control. So it encourages an obsession with control in all areas of men's lives. And, of course, violence is an instrument of control.
Mm-hmm.
So it's inevitable that when you have, you know, just under half of the human species encouraged to measure themselves by their ability to always be in control, especially in relation to women,
mm-hmm.
Then it's inevitable that violence is going to happen.
Why do you say especially in relationship to women?
Well, because a system of male privilege is based on the idea that, first of all, that male and female are simply different kinds of human beings. And the only way you can privilege one group is to set it aside as being superior and different in comparison with the other group, so that the difference between men and women then becomes essential, and so that it becomes essential for men qualifying for male privilege. So the one of the key aspects of patriarchal masculinity is that men should never resemble women at any time. To be not female, to not resemble your mother, that becomes a central measure of successful manhood.
So if men have to see women as different, does that mean they see, well, not all men, obviously. You know,
right.
I'm sure our listeners understand we're talking about, you know, we're talking about generalities here. But if they have to see women as different, does that automatically mean they tend to see them as inferior?
In a patriarchal society, yes. In order for men to see themselves as deserving male privilege, they have to see women and girls as being inferior to them. Patriarchy is also, I'm glad you brought that up, I'm describing a social system here. Individual men participate in this in lots of different ways. But in
give
a patriarchal
examples
of different ways that men participate.
Yeah, how they express their male privilege, you know, how they, you know, how they benefit from the patriarchy as opposed to the other gender that's thwarted by it.
Well, for example, a patriarchal society is male identified, which means that men are seen as the standard for human beings. So that to be a human being is by default is to be male. And women are seen as sort of a variation on that. But men are the real human beings. And when you make any group the standard, whether it's men or white people, then that group is going to be seen as superior. Its point of view is going to be privileged, so that men are encouraged to assume that their point of view on reality, including women's experience, has authority to it. So if a man rapes a woman and he defines that not as a rape, not as a felony, but as, bad sex, a date that went bad, he is encouraged to assume that his take on that is in fact the truth, which then puts him, by privileging his point of view, it puts him in a position to dismiss women's experience, to tell them that they're wrong, that they're making it up, that they're hysterical, that they asked for it. In other words, he's authorized by patriarchy to project all of his reality onto her and not even consider that she might have a completely different reality from his. That's every bit as valid, or actually much more valid than his own, because their point of view on their experience has a validity that his point of view on their experience can't have.
So do you think most men understand male privilege and that it even, I mean, do they even, most of them even know it exists if, you know, they're not somebody like you who's, you know, so well studied in sociology? Let's say, you know, just the average guy out there that you meet in a bar.
I think the default in any system of privilege, whether we're talking about male privilege or white privilege or heterosexual privilege, any form of privilege, the default for the dominant group is to have no awareness at all of the fact that they're on the receiving end of unearned advantages, especially in a country like this one, where we pride ourselves on everyone being equal and everyone being judged on their abilities and all of that. The idea that that we are on the receiving end of something that was unearned is unacceptable. And so, in my experience, most of the time, when you simply if you're with men and you simply use the phrase male privilege, very often you'll get a reaction to that.
Yeah, I have.
And they're objecting to that, that can't be possible, because that is seen as taking something away from them. So the default is to never shine a light on the dominant status of a dominant group, to never call attention to white people's, the status of what of white in this society and what that means, to not call attention to the status of being a man in terms of it giving men access to some kind of unearned advantage. That's not allowed. And we discovered that it's not allowed because when we do it, people get mad at us.
Right. Well, do you believe how patriarchal religion has diminished women's roles of leadership? Do you think that plays a part in maybe giving license for domestic violence?
Well, every institution in a patriarchal society is going to have to, if it's going to survive, it's going to have to mirror the core principles of that patriarchal society, so that if a religion wants to succeed, it has to mirror those core principles, which means it has to mirror the value of male supremacy and male dominance, even if they can't use those words to do it. And of course, religious institutions are incredibly important in every society. And so it's not a surprise and not an accident that those religions are going to mirror male dominance and male identification and male centeredness, beginning with gendering God in most monotheistic religions as masculine.
Well, why is it human beings as a species? Why do they have to lean toward privilege, power, and control rather than partnership? I mean, why can't partnership be the norm, mm-hmm. rather than, well, you know, these sorts of privilege?
Well, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Rhianne Eisler. Well, when you use the word partnership, I think of her mm-hmm. work.
Yeah, that's where it comes from.
I think her response to this would be that for the vast majority of the time that human beings have been on this planet, the model has been a model of partnership. As far as we know, patriarchy is roughly 7,000 years old, give or take, mm-hmm. you know, 500 years or so, which means that that it's a very recent phenomenon in human history. 7,000 years is not all that long when you consider that human beings have been around for 250,000-300,000 years. So the answer is, that, first of all, there's no reason why we can't have a partnership society, in the sense that we have that capability in us as human beings. And so how I hear your question is, where did patriarchy come from? And we don't have a written history of that. We don't know, as a matter of fact, where it came from. My sense is that it came from the developing awareness of the human capacity for control. And, I think this is complicated. In Gender Knot, I try to spell this out as close as I can get to my own understanding of it. Mm-hmm. But I think patriarchy is run by a dynamic relationship between an obsession with control on the one hand and fear on the other. Because control is frightening. When someone tries to exert control over you, it's a threat. It's a frightening
mm-hmm.
thing.
Right.
And the solution to that patriarchy offers is to have more control over them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this cycle that then begins. And I see this everywhere in this society. Someone threatens somebody to control them, and the response is to threaten them even more. If you look at what happened on 9/11, Al-Qaeda tried to control us. They were trying to force us to do things that the United States was not prepared to do.
And they
tried to do it by scaring us, and they sure did.
Right.
Our response to that was a classic patriarchal response,
which was we said, well, you think you can scare us. You haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, shock and awe.
We gave them shock and awe. When Donald Rumsfeld was being interviewed before we invaded Iraq, at one point I was really startled to hear him say that as far as he saw this situation, we had two choices. Either we went to war or we did nothing.
As if there's nothing in between.
And I thought, what an incredible failure of imagination. And this is a guy who went to Princeton, you know. And
yeah.
All he could think of, but he was coming out of a patriarchal imagination in which you are either in control or you are not. And if you are not, and you are a man, especially in a male-identified society, to be seen as being not in control, that is the worst.
Yeah, well,
so
that, you know, in a way, I think maybe I can look at all of that a little bit different from your sort of come from on this. I mean, because I was just thinking in terms of, oh, well, this is just an excuse to, you know, fatten up their portfolios. You know, this is an excuse for Bush to show Daddy he's a man, you know. But it was really, in a way, their masculinity, I guess, was threatened. And so it's like they had to come back with a bigger club.
I think this has been true. I mean, for the entire history of this country, if you look at the way that presidents have behaved, including our current president, who is as much bound by that measurement of his manhood as George Bush or any president before him,
right.
I think their masculinity is absolutely on the line. With Lyndon Johnson, when he was in his last term in office, and this is a matter of public record now, tapes from his office conversations and so on, it was very clear that Johnson knew long before he decided not to run for re-election that the war in Vietnam was unwinnable.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept us in that war because he was one of his main concerns, and this is according to his authorized biographer, was he did not want to be seen as less than manly. That if the perception was that he could not control the outcome of the war in Vietnam, he would not be a real man. And one of the quotes that was attributed to him was that he did not want to be seen as someone who sits down to pee. This is the president. This is the president of the United States, and
right.
this was what was foremost in his mind. His manhood was at stake.
Wow, that's pretty shocking. Okay. All right. Well, let's. I a few articles have come across my desk in the last few days, and one of them was this press release. It said a United Nations expert on women's human rights is investigating why Native American women face the highest rates of sexual and physical assault of any group in the United States. Then there was another one that Gates Rumsfeld are being sued over the U.S. military's mm-hmm. rape epidemic.
Right.
And another one that came out saying, basically sort of same thing, 1 in 3 Native American women is raped in our lifetime, 3 in 5 are assaulted, women soldiers who are sexually assaulted by someone in the military are 4 times more likely to talk about the crime to their families than their commander. Women in prison face not only the deprivation of their liberty and the threat of sexual assault, but also the loss of parental rights. Why is it these groups, do you think, or should I rephrase it, do you think these groups are particularly susceptible?
I'm suspicious of the comparison with Native Americans, because when they say 1 out of every 3 Native American women can be assaulted during their lifetimes, I don't think the data for non-Native American women in the United States are a whole lot different.
Okay.
So I'm not so sure about that. The military, I mean, the what happens to women in the military to me is a direct outgrowth of the nature of the institution. The military, aside from professional football, the military is the quintessential patriarchal masculine institution. It's the institutionalization of the use of violence in order to control. That's what the military does.
Well, do you think part of it might also be that they really never wanted women there? And do you think it's a problem in the militaries across the globe, or is it just the American military, or do you know?
Well, first I would say that, yes, they don't want them there because men have an investment in having a monopoly over that institution because it is the clearest statement of patriarchal masculinity, of the ideal manhood, is embodied in the ideal of the soldier. And so to admit women into that, to acknowledge that women might be able to realize that patriarchal ideal to the same extent that men can, certainly is going to be a threat to them. As to whether it's as serious a problem in other countries, I don't know, for as a matter of fact. I would guess that it is not as great a problem because international studies have found that American men are more concerned about the patriarchal ideal of the tough masculine man than men in Europe, for example, which is not to say men in Europe aren't affected by this, but it's much stronger in the United States. They found that fathers in the United States are much more concerned about their sons really appearing to match that masculine ideal than fathers in Europe.
Okay. Well, so do you think, you know, that's in a way that's why the country, or at least half of the country, has gone so berserk over gay rights mm-hmm. and, you know, and our black president suddenly, now that's also threatening white male privilege. I mean, is
very
that really
so.
What's behind the insanity?
Well, I think there's a very strong, and there are a lot of people who've done this analysis. I think the connection between heterosexism and male privilege is very, very strong. Because, again, male privilege is based on a certain view of manhood and masculinity. And part of that, as I was saying earlier, is defined through men's controlling relationship with women. And gay men don't live that out in the way
mm-hmm.
that straight men do.
Mm-hmm.
And so just in that sense, they are a threat.
Well, and I wonder if men have an issue with women who are with women because they're sort of left out of the equation. That probably affects their ego as well.
Very much so, lesbian women are opting out of the heterosexual system altogether. They're, in effect, they are not putting themselves in a position where men have the potential to control them, especially sexually.
Right, right. All right, so we know there's racism and white privilege. We know there's patriarchy and male privilege. And then there's socioeconomic privilege. Like on the political scene, like with Citizens United, the rich buying our democracy, or even what's going on in Wisconsin right now, you know, the money-backed
mm-hmm.
Wisconsin governor is fighting the middle class who's already squeezed. Are these all examples of socioeconomic privilege?
Oh yes, class is sort of a tricky case because it's different than race and gender. Class is something that you actually have the potential to change during your life. It's a lot dicier to try to change your gender position in this society. People do it, and of course there are people who straddle the boundaries between those two categories all the time.
You mean like transgenders and people like that? Okay.
Yeah, so we have this rigorous idea that there are only two genders and everybody else is just sort of outside of that system altogether, and that's starting to break down.
Mm-hmm.
But class is something that is much more subject to change, so it's in that sense it's different. But there's an extraordinarily powerful system of class privilege in this country, excuse me, and it interacts especially powerfully with race. I mean, the whole history of white privilege in the United States was based on economics. Sorry.
It's okay.
It was based on economics, and especially the capitalist industrial revolution. So it's really impossible to separate out white privilege from the long history of class relations in the United States. And class privilege has been used as a lever to get working class white people in the United States to see people of color as their enemies rather than seeing them as their allies in a class struggle. And that was effective with strike breaking in 100 years ago. And I think we're seeing another version of it now with the whole controversy around illegal immigration, that working class people in the United States and middle class people who are under all kinds of duress because of the way the economic system operates are being encouraged to see people of color as the enemy, as the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and instead of focusing their attention on the larger picture.
Well, now, you said at the top of our conversation that you never talk about the white privilege or the male privilege. You know, if that's sort of, you keep that below the surface. So I'm thinking it must be the same with socioeconomic privilege, because I'm amazed that people everywhere aren't screaming from the top of their lungs about this class privilege going on. Is it just a conspiracy of the media?
I wish it was that simple, because then we would just go pick at the media and break down the doors. But the United States is based on an economic system from the very beginning, which people have been encouraged to see as being an avenue to your own success. And capitalism has taken on a kind of sacred status in this country because of that. So you're not allowed to talk about capitalism. You can talk about bad rich people, for example, or bad bankers. You know, if you look at what happened, you know, what was it, 3 years ago now, with the whole financial meltdown, we were encouraged to see this as the result of a set of bad individuals doing bad things. And then everybody wanted their heads. Everybody wanted to go out and get them and punish them. And then when they got bailouts, everybody was mad at those individuals because they were being rewarded, it seemed, for the bad things that they did. What was not in the conversation was that we're participating in an economic system that encourages what they did. It encourages people to gamble. Our economic system is organized like a big casino.
Right.
And people are encouraged to go out there and win. People think it's a legitimate
institution, and the debt's not stacked against them. But, you know, a lot of people think now, well, you just as well go play the casinos in Las Vegas, because the integrity really was never there. It was an illusion.
Yeah, one of the things that they found in studying the economic meltdown, and the ones that have come before, because there have been many, is that very often what leads up to it is a period of a growing disparity in the distribution of wealth. And so you have a small group of people at the top who have an incredible amount of wealth. And the question is, what are they going to do with all that wealth? And what they do with it, since there are only so many houses you can own, what they do with it is they gamble. And that's exactly what the financiers were doing. They were gambling. They were gambling in relation to things that didn't exist. They were gambling on pieces of paper. They were gambling on investments that were bets that somebody would default on their debts. I mean, they're investing in nothing. They're gambling.
Well, and I guess what amazes me, and because these got to be intelligent people, maybe they're just not very aware people, but, you know, it's as if they were oblivious or about their recklessness in the lives it would affect. It's like, you know, they were untouchable, or they didn't even think beyond, I don't know, their adrenaline rush. I don't know, Alan, you tell me.
So I would say there is no distinction. I would make no distinction. I agree with you. I would see no difference between that and a man being totally oblivious to the effects of sexual aggression against a woman, having no concept of what he is doing, of raping a woman and then asking her afterwards if she'd like to see him later for a date. This happens. this is not an unusual thing in sexual assault.
Right. So you might
think that he's crazy, that there's some kind of, you know, how could an intelligent man think that way? And I think my point is that we're in a social system that encourages men to think that way, that authorizes them to do that.
Well, and you have so many people, you know, especially athletes, who have gotten away with so many, you know, rapes and things like that. It's almost, you know, it's like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know. At least that's what it seems like.
Well, Catherine MacKinnon, a lawyer in the law school at University of Michigan, who wrote extensively about sexual violence and pornography, once said that rape is not forbidden in the United States. It's regulated.
Yeah. And by that she meant...
There are laws whose primary function seems to be to keep it within a certain bounds. Just as in a football game, you have rules to keep the violence within certain boundaries. In warfare, you have rules that keep the violence within certain boundaries.
Oh,
and
sort of
with,
like that old that old law where you could beat your wife if the stick was only
as
so thick.
As long as the stick wasn't too thick. And so that those rules become a way of not preventing the violence, but of, as MacKinnon says, of regulating it, which winds up actually protecting it. So the Geneva Convention, all these rules about what you can and can't do to people in war, has the effect of legitimating war, of perpetuating war, by making it somehow within bounds. It's not
savagery. Yeah, some
savagery.
Things are acceptable.
Some
atrocities are acceptable.
Yes, you cannot shoot an unarmed prisoner of war, but you can firebomb a whole city, as they did with Dresden during World War II.
Right, right. Well, let me ask you this, Alan. Is there such a – I mean, I've never heard this before. I came up with this question for you for this show because I feel like I see it. Is there such a thing in this country as Christian privilege?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean – no one would get up and say that this is a Muslim nation or a Buddhist nation, but people all the time stand up and say that this is a Christian nation. And in doing that, they're reflecting the belief that Christianity is a superior religion, is the one true religion, and certainly in this society is the religion that somehow sets the standard. So to be religious in this society, in this culture, is to be Christian. And so Christianity gets privileged, and one of the ways in which that's seen is in the reaction of many Christians to any kind of restriction on their expression of their faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a cardinal rule of privilege that dominant groups, however they're defined, are never supposed to feel restrained by
mm-hmm.
subordinate groups. So what that would mean then in a Christian-identified society, that would mean that Christians should never have to restrain themselves in any way in their expressions of their faith, including in public.
But all you ever hear from them is the opposite, that they're so put upon.
Well, when you have this privilege that says, I should never be restrained in any way, then it takes a very small amount of restraint to provoke a reaction. And the reaction will tend to be, as we see, one of outrage, of imposition. This is unfair. You're after us. We're being driven out. When, in fact, what's happening is there's been some small measure of restraint placed upon the dominant group. And privilege, that's the opposite of privilege. That's not supposed to happen. When men are told that they have to be careful about how they talk to women, when white people are told they have to be careful about how they talk about people of color, just to be mindful,
mm-hmm.
very often the reaction is that their freedoms are being abridged. That this is unjust and unfair.
They're resentful.
And that sense of imposition is an expression of privilege.
Yeah. Well, it's almost as if privilege trumps mismanners, you know? I mean, it's almost like there's no etiquette. There's no respect. Well, obviously not. I guess that was stupid. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, that what you just said about you have to be mindful that you don't insult people. I mean, I would think most mothers would teach that to their children, you know? But I guess I grew up in a different world.
Well, I'm not sure that it's a different world. Mothers also want their children to fit into the world. That's their biggest job.
Mm-hmm.
They want their children to be liked. They want their children to be successful, however successful is defined in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So when her little boy is teased by his classmates for being a mama's boy because he still loves and needs his mother, even if he's only 6 years old, she's really in a bind. Because on the one hand, she probably knows that his attachment to her is one of the most crucial things to his maturation as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, on the other hand, she doesn't want him coming home getting beat up every time. And she doesn't want him to be seen as not a real boy, a real man.
Right.
So she's in a bind. And so that many mothers play a role in essentially giving their sons up to patriarchal manhood is a surprise.
Oh, I see. So they give him up so he fits in rather than raising him maybe the way she would actually prefer he be raised, with a you know, kinder, gentler sort.
Yes. Because she knows, I think women are more likely to know this than men. I think she knows that his humanity is at stake here. And patriarchal manhood is very much at odds with what I consider full humanity. To be a successful man in this society requires you to give up a lot of the hallmarks of being a full human being, one of the most important being empathy. Empathy gets in the way of control. empathy gets in the way of being able to inflict violence on people. And
right.
many men who go to war are horrified when they are not able to suppress their empathy, and they do things to other human beings that traumatize them for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And we've got thousands of soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been traumatized by their own actions, and they haven't broken the rules. But
you don't really hear about that either, do you? Unless you're in counseling sessions, probably, with these people.
We are very carefully shielded from seeing the amount of psychic devastation that is once again happening to a whole generation of young men, and of course young women now increasingly are being involved in this kind of trauma.
Right. Well, you know, I was just thinking, you said one of the things we never really talk about is capitalism, in a negative sense. You know, it strikes me one of the other words that people tend to shy away from, and I guess that's part of the smokescreen of denial, is patriarchy. It's almost, you know, some people think of it as a dirty word, or if they hear it, they go, oh, it must be one of those angry feminists again.
Well, any language that illuminates reality when it comes to systems of privilege is going to be attacked.
Right.
And in the 1970s, the word patriarchy was all over the place because the radical feminist movement was making use of it to point to reality.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the reaction against that was to try to demonize that word and demonize the people who identified themselves and their work with it. And it was, unfortunately, it's been really successful. When I do presentations to university audiences and I describe patriarchy, rarely do I get people in the audience saying, you're not describing the world that I live in. It's just the opposite. They go, oh, yeah, I know that world. I understand that world.
So are you saying they recognize it now, that things are getting better? Or the opposite?
I don't think it's because it's getting better. I think it's because it accurately describes the world. In the 1970s, the radical feminism was right on the money. They were describing reality, and it really resonated with people.
Mm-hmm.
I find when I talk about capitalism to audiences, they recognize what I'm talking about, especially after the last 3 years. They get it in about 30 seconds. They know,
right.
and sometimes they'll ask me, you know, what's your perspective? Are you a Marxist and all this stuff? And I say, well, the only really critical analysis of how capitalism works came from Karl Marx. He was a really smart guy who spent a lot of time in the library studying up. And the fact is that his analysis of what's happening in this country right now and has been for centuries is right on the money.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how does it work, these recurring crises that we have, and who pays for those crises. He saw this 200 years ago.
Right. Well, you know, shifting gears a little bit, going back to sexual coercion, or I don't know, maybe you'd call it reproductive coercion. On the Ms. Magazine blog today, they had an article called What Abusers and Pro-Family Conservatives Have in Common. And they were talking about how restricting shelters keep women under the thumb of abusive men, denying women birth control or abortion, you know, women are trapped. So these are all versions of coercion. And I guess I just, you know, what would you say to that?
Women's autonomy, which is probably most powerfully embodied in among lesbians, women's autonomy is the single greatest threat to patriarchy. And one way in which that gets accomplished is when women demand that the violence of men against them be recognized and that they be protected from it by their society.
Mm-hmm.
The threat in that is that it raises the awareness that the problem here is men as a group.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not just some number of individual men who are crazy or awful and mean and bad and evil. The problem is something much larger than that. And when you make domestic violence, I mean, in my novel about domestic violence, the abuser is not a monster. That comes out through the course of the novel, that seeing him as a monster actually covers up the problem. And I think that the demand that domestic violence and sexual violence be seen as something larger than the actions of an individual man is deeply threatening to patriarchy, which is why we go to such extreme lengths to avoid looking at it that way. We can say we can talk about violence against women, for example, as if it's just something that happens, like, you know, stormy weather.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to talk about men's violence against women, if you want to use that phrase, if you want to include the word men in the definition of the problem, you get all kinds of resistance. And I've run into this in domestic violence programs, in state legislatures. There's tremendous resistance to identifying the violence as men's violence.
An issue, a man's issue.
I believe it is. Men's violence is clearly a women's issue, a children's issue, and so on, because they get victimized by it. But in terms of the cause,
right,
men's violence is a men's problem. And it's not just a problem for the individual men who do the violence. It's a problem for all men in this society, because we are all complicit in a patriarchal system that privileges us in part through this obsession with control, of which violence is an instrument.
And control goes back to why some of these groups are against birth control, against abortion, because then women have more autonomy.
I believe so. I think that's a huge part of it, yes.
Okay. Well, I want to start talking about your book, but someone just emailed me and said, ask him, please, why do women keep going back to their abusers? What's happening in their psyche that enables them to continue to be victimized over and over again?
Well, first of all, I think that I would first take issue with the way the question's put. The women go back to their abusers. In other words, women escape their abusers and then go back to them. I don't think that's that common at all. Does it happen? I'm sure. Everything happens. But I don't think that's the pattern. The pattern is that women find themselves held prisoner inside of usually apartments and houses. They are held prisoner. They are terrorized. And the question is, how do they get out of that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are several answers to that. The first answer is that they're scared to get out of it, and they are accurately perceiving that the most dangerous thing they can do is to leave. That, in fact, is when women are most likely to be murdered by their abusers, is when they do what everyone says they're supposed to do. They get out. They get tracked down, and they get killed. That's when they're most likely to be murdered. The second thing is that for many women, they have nowhere to go. They have children a lot of the time. They have no money. They literally have no place to go. So they have no means to get out. And I think the third thing, which I became most aware of when a key source for me in writing this novel was a book called Trauma and Recovery by Judith Lewis Herman, who's a physician near Boston. And she's writing about severe trauma, and she's likening the severe trauma that battered women experience with the trauma of men in warfare, for example, because in terms of the emotional consequences are identical. And what happens with women who get imprisoned in this kind of a situation is that they find themselves in a situation that is violent and that is beyond their control and is unpredictable. They can get attacked at any time for any reason. The men go to extreme lengths to cut them off from their friends, from outside contact, from their families, and very quickly it becomes very effective. Similar things get done to prisoners of war,
mm-hmm,
when they get isolated, and it turns their reality all around. It becomes very difficult for them to form a thought, to form an intention, to follow through on that intention when you're constantly being subjected 24 hours a day to unpredictable violence. It becomes very disorienting.
It's not as simple as people on the outside looking in would think.
No, they think that she's in this sort of this rational position where she can just sort of step back from all of this and do the rational thing and get out. And if you look at the experience of people who are in extreme trauma situations, whether they're prisoners of war or women who are being battered, they are astonishingly similar. When they train executives to go to South America who might be kidnapped by terrorists, one of the things they tell them is that if you are kidnapped, do not do anything that will aggravate the people who've captured you. Be docile, do exactly what they tell you to do, do not try to escape. This is the professional advice to people who are basically put in the same kind of situation that battered women are in. And yet everybody stands around, and notice what's happening in effect, is the woman, the victim, is being blamed for his behavior. If she would just behave differently, he would stop beating her, instead of asking the question, why are so many men beating up the women they say they love?
Right.
So the
right.
focus becomes on the victim. It's her fault, not his fault.
Well, now in your book, the first, your fiction book about domestic violence, The First Thing and the Last, was this book sort of your way about talking about social justice through fiction?
Well, yes and no. I started out as a fiction writer. When I was young, I wrote fiction and poetry all through high school and college. That was really my sole work, I think, S-O-U-L work. And then I became trained in sociology and spent the better part of 30 years trying to understand men's violence against women, but writing nonfiction. And at one point about, 10, 11 years ago, my long partner in life, Nora, said to me, I wish someone would write a novel that tells the truth about domestic violence. And that planted a seed. And I was also at that point in my life ready to go back to fiction. And this novel started coming to me. This story started coming to me. And I didn't write it in order to teach. I didn't write it. It's not nonfiction. I was writing it because this story came to me and it grabbed me by the lapels and wouldn't let go.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I had to write it. That's where it came from.
Well, now in reading about the book's birth, it was a difficult journey because what you say is some of the scenes were just too much for publishers. I one of the things I read in the book that sort of struck me is this poor woman was even afraid to go take a bath. Mm-hmm. Is it the idea that even the something so simple as that can just be stolen from you? You know, your psyche can be so warped that you're afraid to even go bathe because of past things that maybe have happened to you.
Yeah, there's this kind of psychic murder that can happen. I think that's what you're talking about. Publishers, there were, just so your listeners probably don't know this, but the novel was represented by an agent in New York for almost 6 years, and it was turned down almost 60 times by commercial publishers, some of them more than once. And the objection was not that the violence was extreme or, gross or anything like that, because it's not. And the violence is contained in the first 50 pages of a 400-page novel. Their objection most often was that the violence was too real. And that puzzled me for years, and it puzzled my agent. Like, it's too real? I mean, the girl with the dragon tattoo is all the rage now, and this is full of grotesque violence. And this novel they rejected because the violence was too real. And
give us an example of maybe what they thought was too real?
I think you gave us an example.
Okay.
That she is so terrorized that she's afraid to take a bath. In other words, this violence is not... the reason that the girl with the dragon tattoo can attract such a big audience is that people don't identify with her as a
mm-hmm.
victim of violence. It's comic book violence.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't
mm-hmm.
break your heart. It may shock you, but it doesn't break your heart. It doesn't make you think, oh, this could happen to me, or this has happened to me, or this could happen to someone I know, or this has happened to someone I know. That's what too real is about. It's too close to home. I had editors rejecting the novel because her son is killed in the first part of this novel, and one editor at a big house rejected the novel because she said, I have a little boy his age. That was her reason for rejecting the novel. In other words, this was too close to home. This was too much like real life.
Yeah, it could be your sister or the neighbor next door rather than somebody in some faraway land.
And the fact is, in this country, it probably is your sister or your neighbor next door. We may not know that we know women who are battered or who have been battered, but the statistics are pretty clear that most of us do know someone who has been battered or is being battered. We just
right.
aren't. We don't know that we know. It's
and
like
the people who, the women who say they're staying for the kids. I mean, the kids are being, the kids' psyches are being destroyed in the process of watching this as well. I mean, that's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Right. Yes. I think that the blaming of women, I think, is a failure to understand what severe trauma is about.
Right.
I think most of us have no idea what severe trauma is really about.
Right.
And we assume a kind of rational control that people have in situations where they are being severely traumatized that is simply not there.
Or judgment, some sort of judgment.
And there's a judgment made of them.
Well, Alan, we probably have about 10 minutes here. Where do you think we should go with this? I know you have something, you talk about the dilemmas of manhood and fatherhood, or what can we do to work against the divides of privilege, power, and difference? I mean, what do you think is more important to talk about? How men need to change, or what we can all do?
Well, I want to say one more thing about the novel.
Sure.
If I may. And that is the novel's a little over 400 pages long. And out of that, about 4 or 5 pages of it actually contain descriptions of actual violence. The vast majority of this novel is about what happens to Catherine after the violence.
Mm-hmm. How she recovers.
It's about how she tries to understand what has been taken from her and to find out what of that she can reclaim for herself, which is what faces everyone who's victimized by severe trauma, whatever the form that it takes. And I just want people to be aware that that's what this novel is really about, her relationship with an elderly woman named Lucy Dudley, who seeks her out from Vermont, and Catherine goes and accepts her invitation to go to Vermont and live with her on her farm. And that's what this novel is really about. It's about how you find yourself in a position where you've lost everything and you're falling into this abyss, and someone reaches in and grabs hold of you.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy can't save her, but Lucy also doesn't let go. And I want people to know that's what this novel is really about. But to make it ring true, I had to make the violence real.
Well, and Lucy does a simple thing for her when the poor woman is afraid to go take a bath. She just sits outside the door and it helps her, I guess, feel a modicum of safety.
Right. She sits out. She says, "I'll be your crone at the door. I'll stand guard." And she sits outside the door and she reads to her while Catherine sits in the tub. And Catherine's journey is one step like this after another, and it's a long journey. Some of the editors complained that the healing part of the novel was slower than the trauma part of the novel, and I wanted to say, trauma's quick and healing is slow.
Is slow, absolutely. People always think, just get over it. Aren't you over it yet?
exactly.
So do men need to change, Alan, or is it society that needs to change?
Well, it's both and, of course. And these days, I'm painfully aware of how easily, as a society, we do not live in we avoid living in reality. The financial meltdown is a beautiful example of that, a painful example of how the whole world was living in unreality. We thought we could live on debt forever and never have to pay it off. That's not living in reality, and it's very dangerous. We're not living in reality about global warming. We're still not living in reality about it. And we don't live in reality about male privilege. We don't live in reality about all forms of privilege in this country. And I know that because every time someone brings it up, they're shouted down. They're told you're engaging in class warfare, you hate men, you hate white people. You get shouted down.
Or look at Glenn Beck always raging against social justice like it's a horrible thing.
So to me, where we have to begin is where we are, which is in a state of dangerous unreality. And the most powerful thing any of us can do is to position ourselves so that living in reality is one of our commitments. And it takes work, especially when you're surrounded by all these encouragements to not live in reality. So that if we're talking about male privilege, what do men have to do? Well, it's the same thing that women have to do, although I think men are much farther behind than women are. We have to educate ourselves. We have to make this something that is important to us, important enough for us to make a commitment for our, if not just for ourselves, but our children, our grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
to live in reality.
Right.
Because of
and
the dangers
even
of
if that means even if that means rejecting institutions like the church, who would perpetuate these abuses.
Well, many women have been running that risk for a long, long time now. Challenging their churches, which is a terribly brave and risky thing to do. And yes, including that. But I think the biggest risk for men, if we're talking about male privilege, the biggest risk for men is their relations with other men. That's where it really gets tough. Because
you
men
mean
have
so that they still need to look powerful kind of a thing? They can't show a chink in the armor?
They have to risk the disapproval and the rejection of other men.
Ah.
And in a patriarchal society, and you know, boys learn this when they're really young. They learn this when they're really young. You don't play with the girls, because if the boys reject you, you're in deep trouble. And they continue to learn that their whole lives. It's just that, you know, in the schoolyard you get beat up, but in the, you know, in the workplace, you get beat up in a different way.
Well, you know, I hate to ask you for a quick answer, but we only have like 3 minutes left. How does a mother raise her son to not fall into this this pit?
Well,
you know, how does he straddle the fence?
There's a guy named Pollack who wrote a book called Real Boys, which I recommend. He's a psychiatrist at Harvard who's worked with troubled boys his whole career. And Pollack says that one of the linchpins, he doesn't use the word patriarchy. He doesn't include this in his analysis, but I forgive him for that. Because what he points out is that a boy's attachment to his mother developmentally is one of the most important things in his life. You need your mother your whole life. My mother's been dead for 12 years, and I need my mother. It's simply a fact of human nature. Our mothers are tremendously important to us. And the most important thing that mothers can do, and it probably will require the help of the father, is for him to maintain his attachment to his mother, his heart attachment to his mother, his need for his mother, his ability to identify with her. He's supposed to disidentify with her. He's supposed to not be female. He's supposed to be not mama. He's supposed to be daddy. And Pollack says, developmentally, this is a disaster. And this is the norm in this society, for boys to renounce their mothers, to not express any need for their mothers, to not identify with their mothers. And
well,
what he's saying is
yes,
that
it's about reclaiming the feminine in their yang.
Yes, which is, and what that really is about, maintaining his identification with his mother, is about maintaining his full humanity.
Yes.
That's what it's really about. It's maintaining his full humanity. And I know so many men in my life who do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are huge numbers of men in this society who did maintain their identification with their mothers, but they found out how to hide that from other men.
Mm-hmm.
They are in the closet, if you will, around this issue. And when they're with their female partners, or if they're heterosexual, or when they're with their children, they behave very differently than when they were out with the guys.
Right.
They compartmentalize their lives because they know they have to protect themselves. So this is totally possible to do this.
Okay. Well, Alan, I would love to talk to you for another hour. I'm sorry I didn't book you for the whole show. But we're about to go off the air here in about 1 minute. So I want 90 seconds. So I want to make sure we give your website. Would you go ahead and give that to listeners, please?
Yeah, it's www.agjohnson, my name, agjohnson.com.
Okay, and your wonderful book on domestic violence, The First Thing and the Last. Alan, I just want to say thank you for being one of the good guys out there, you know, because I think it's so much more important, this information coming from a man.
Well, I thank you for having me.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so very much, and you know, I hope we meet again soon.
I hope so too. Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, we're about ready to go off the air here. Hope you enjoyed the show tonight, and please tune in next Wednesday. We're going to have Pam Wells on the show. She's an author and artist. We're going to be talking about her beautiful deck, tarot-like deck, Affirmations for Everyday, goddess book and cards discussing goddesses, mystery, change, inner knowledge, connection with the one. And Julie Lohr, author of Goddesses, we're going to be talking about goddess through astrology and symbols. Also some talk on a popular subject here, Lilith. Lilith was what I said, if you didn't hear. So thank you very much for tuning in tonight, and I will see you next week. Good night, listeners.
Let's rip the